This is News in Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, is Iraq ready to stand alone? And a gay teen's parents send him to a Christian conversion camp. Also, the Secretary of State's ire is raised. In our New York bureau, Bob Meadows, writer for People magazine, joins us. Also with us, Bev Smith, host of The Bev Smith Show on American Urban Radio Network. She joins us from WDUQ in Pittsburgh and at NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. My good friend Cortland Malloy, Metro columnist at The Washington Post. And this is his maiden voyage on the roundtable for us. You often hear him give commentary here. Before we get into the issues that I just talked about, we want to talk about the scare again, London rocked by explosions. Bob Meadows, when we see this has to be one of those things where we say it to ourselves constantly, but we don't really want to admit it. This is the world in which we live today.
You know, it's a world that a lot of nations have been facing for generations, for millennia even. And right now, it's really coming to the United States, to London, to England, to different countries, and it's really spreading. I think a lot of it has to go back, of course, to the war in Iraq, which is escalating tensions. You see that all over. And as you said, Ed, this is the world we are living in today.
Cortland, when you think about London is a city that during the IRA days, certainly knew terrorism. But as we say, one has to believe that people at some level, particularly in the United States, when we see these events staged and happen because of the globalization of the world today, really see this as problematic, and we're just really ticking and waiting for something to happen here, don't you think?
Yes, Ed, and it's good to be with you here with the listeners. There's a lot of nervousness about the state of affairs now, and I think one of the most striking aspects of this is for years now, President Bush has been saying that we're fighting in Iraq so we won't have to fight here on our own soil. I don't know if that's going down too well with Londoners these days, but it certainly shows that that is not the case, and that given the fact that Britain is so much more experienced with these kind of activities and still was not able to stop it, then we are pretty vulnerable as well.
When you think about the alliance that has been built between Tony Blair and this president, as well as his predecessors, Bev, whether or not these attacks are tied to the involvement in the Iraqi war or not, as we said a few weeks ago, I raised the idea that we are really living in a changed world, not only that we are readying ourselves for terrorism at any time, but we are really seeing for the first time, I think, more and more countries not afraid to stand up to the, quote, superpowers.
I think that's because of the way the superpowers have behaved. I think that's because of the way the superpowers, and primarily we mean the United States and Great Britain, have not used diplomacy and have used a forceful hand. But I'm not so willing to jump on the bandwagon that this may have been terrorist. We do know, and it's too soon to tell, but we do know that in Great Britain there have been a lot of tests going on from the paramilitary in Great Britain, from the military in Great Britain, and from the police. So we really don't know whether these detonators, because that was what was assumed when I heard the last report, were as a result of some of the practices or if someone really is trying to duplicate what happened before. And the information about what happened before is still not clear. So I think we better go slow with this one and not rush to judgment. As to whether we're prepared or not, I don't think we're prepared at all. I think England is far better prepared to handle this than we are. Remember, most of our reservists and others are in Iraq, and our citizens are not prepared for anything like that. We don't even have drills in schools anymore.
Right. Well, we're not talking about, obviously, anything specifically that happened today, but more of a broader discussion of the idea of events that continue to occur around the globe. Here's something that we found interesting that hit the newspapers today that may speak to how long, if indeed many of these incidents are tied to involvement in Iraq, how long this may be problematic. And there is a report released by the Pentagon to senators today that will not, we're told, officially be released to the public, that says about half of the Iraqi police battalions are still not established and cannot conduct operations, and another half of the police units and two-thirds of the new army battalions are only partially capable of carrying out missions. When you hear this, Courtland Malloy, and you hear the Bush administration saying that we will not abandon this war midway, we will make sure that when we leave, Iraq can stand on its own, how concerned are you that we will not see in any way, shape, or form in the immediate future an exodus?
Yeah, I think we'll be there for years if that will be the standard. I'm not so sure that the American public has a indefinite patience when it comes to watching our children die in Iraq while the administration continues to mislead us, basically. We were told during the election campaign that there were more Iraqi security forces and military personnel ready than we're finding out now, which is one of the reasons I think Bush's credibility is falling so fast. But if we are going to stay in Iraq until Iraq is ready, given the fact that, number one, we aren't sure that the American approach to training military people, the strategies, the techniques, can actually work. Iraq is not the United States, and I don't think the military planners, the politicians, or even the American people at this point fully understand just how different a place it is, and we'll be pouring money and people down a hole for a long time, in my view.
Bev Smith, as I've talked to people in the administration, they bristle at the thought of using the word quagmire. But even John McCain has suggested the American people, and these are in his words, need to know the status of readiness of the Iraqi military. If indeed this report is true, and it says that the military isn't really anywhere close to being ready, does not that place the Bush administration in a tremendous quagmire?
I think quagmire is an excellent word. And I think what is going to happen is, as we look at the readiness of the Iraqi military or the non-readiness of the Iraqi military, we're also going to have to focus on what is happening to our own men and women. There has not been a national debate on that. The fact that I've interviewed on my show dozens and dozens of soldiers coming back from Iraq who report that they don't have guns to shoot, the same kinds of issues that cropped up in the Vietnam War. And I think as we look at the readiness or the not ready, because that's what should be stamped on them, we're going to find out that we can't get them ready because our troops are fighting for their lives and they're not ready. The fact that soldiers have to send home for equipment that we've already paid for, and mothers have to raise money by baking dinners and having car wash to send their sons and daughters equipment so they can see at night to fight an enemy that they don't even know about. I think it suggests that right from the very beginning, not only was it a quagmire, but it is sinking sand. And this could go on for decades longer than Vietnam, which was exactly what those of us who were opposed to the war said as it early began.
Bob, there's a certain irony, Bob, with the passing of General Westmoreland this week, a man who steadfastly could not admit, quite frankly, to the end, that the Vietnam War was one that we were not used to fighting, the kind of war we fought there. It was the first time that history probably tells us that America really could not go in with sheer military might and defeat an enemy. And it put us in a precarious and tenuous position militarily when we see possibly, I underline that word, the same kind of thing happening here. One has to believe that the United States will not pull up stake midway through, even if they see it not going the way and going down a road they know will be too problematic. Is this one of those things that says we're not learning from our history?
Absolutely, because all you have to do is look at the history of the Iraqi people and realize that they have been fighting, as we said before on the show, they've been fighting for millennia. They're not the type of people. We could defeat Iraq, but we're not going to go over there and start to rule the country. And as what happened in Vietnam, you know, the only way to win some types of wars is if you kill everybody in the country, and you're just not going to do that. What Vietnam showed was that just because you are stronger than somebody doesn't mean you can actually rule over them.
Bev, the idea... Go ahead.
One of the things that I think we need to stress is that that is exactly what the president sold the American public on. We were going to ride in there like a John Wayne movie, kill up all the enemy. And the fact is, Ed, we don't even know who the enemy is. The fact is that for an Iraqi citizen to join one of our militarily trained groups could get them and their family killed. That's another thing that's not being exposed. Even if there are citizens who want to be a part of the new military, they're afraid because you don't know who the terrorists are, and they could be your next door neighbor. Mm-hmm. So you have people who are refusing to even sign up. So that's why we're training police officers, because we cannot get Iraqis to sign up to the degree that they're signing up on the other side. We have major problems in our philosophy, but our philosophy was wrong. Because we did not go in with respect for the country, the differences in the religion, the differences in the group. We went in with a gun, and that never wins.
Courtland, isn't part of the problem here, quite frankly, that there is a whole generation of Americans that only knew Grenada as a war, where we really could march in with some 10 soldiers, knock folks off the map, and say, this is it. And also know of what I call a quiet war, and that is a war like the one we wage in Afghanistan, where it seems, and certainly has seemed for years, this is one of those wars that goes on, casualties happen, but for whatever reasons, do not hit the front page and make the headlines like war, quite frankly, should, to make sure that people understand what's going on.
Yes, I would date it not so much to Grenada, but to 9/11, when America was in a revenge mode, and it almost didn't make any difference. Somebody had to pay. And the linking Saddam Hussein to Al-Qaeda to the 9/11 attacks, even though we now know that the attack on Iraq was planned even before 9/11. Let me just say that the administration has not been right about anything that they have said regarding this war, not from the WMDs to the connection with Al-Qaeda to how long it would take to how much it would cost. Nothing has been the case. And yet we continue to, like Westmoreland, throw good money after bad, good people to their graves. And I think it's just atrocious.
Let me turn our attention to something that happened on the current trip of Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, and that is that she has demanded an apology from the Sudanese government after officials there, and we should say security officials, manhandled some U.S. aides and journalists who were accompanying the Secretary of State on her trip to Africa. Some of the journalists were asking the Sudanese president about some indiscretions that have occurred there in the country, and these U.S. journalists were swept away by security. Doors were slammed in their faces, and included in that sweeping up were some of the aides that are traveling with Secretary of State Rice. Bob Meadows, it's interesting here. The point is, in this demand of an apology, when in Rome, do as the Romans, and that is, you know not to ask those kinds of questions. The freedom of the press is not the same in Sudan as it is in the United States. Or do you go ahead, ask those questions, and assume that the Sudanese government, who will be looking for certain things from America, from this trip, should understand that this is what comes with the territory?
Well, I think you have to ask the questions that you want to ask if you're a journalist. If somebody's pointing a gun in your face, you may want to use some discretion, but you have to go in with what you want to know. And one of the things that this reminded me of was, you know, it's nice to see the Bush government defending journalism for a change. But it reminded me is when I was covering his campaign back in 2000, that he actually had a really good relationship with journalists. And despite what you see now with going on with Karl Rove, and Bush was actually saying that the journalists shouldn't be defended or shielded, Because it would be against terrorism. All the journalists really liked him, and I think that was one of the reasons he won the election.
Courtland?
Yeah, it's very difficult to defend anything that the Sudanese government has done. I mean, these are people who have been engaged in genocide. I mean, millions of people, at least hundreds of thousands, have been killed. And I just don't think that you gain anything. I mean, what is the president going to say? Oh, yes, I ordered the attacks on the village. I killed all those people. They're not going to do it. In diplomatic terms, people are regarded as guests in one's home and host. And I think Condoleezza's right. People were correct in saying that, as guests in our home, as guests in their homes, that, we are not to be roughed up like that. By the same token, a guest in the home does not misbehave as well. And I think you have to look at how foreign reporters treat President Bush when they come to this country. No one would ever, ask President Bush whether he stole the election in 2000, that kind of thing. So,
deference to the position more than anything.
Absolutely. I mean, the press is not operating as an arm of the government.
Bev, with about a minute to go, literally.
Well, I really think that we need to examine the relationship that the United States has had with Sudan. We are quiet and have been quiet until Tony Blair raised the issue. And I think that there are strained relationships between the puppets that we help put in place in government and the like. If we allow those questions to be answered, then we would have to ask what role the United States played in when it was silent about all the atrocities. And I think that that may be some of the feelings that we have, that we want to find out more. And we're not going to find out more in a press conference in a country as their guest. We're going to have to leave the president's palace and go somewhere else to get the real answers. And it might be to the president here in the United States.
That's an interesting point, Bev, because Andrea Mitchell of NBC News was one of those reporters, and I've known Andrea for years, and she is an outstanding journalist, but one would say that the U.S. press corps should, in fact, turn some of those questions, as you suggest, to the American side of the problem as well. Bev Smith, Courtland Malloy, and Bob Meadows, thank you all for joining us. Courtland, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ed.
All right. Coming up in Political Corner, Juan Williams explores Democrats' impressions of the president's Supreme Court nominee and the push toward more African-American investors in the stock market. All that to come